From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. A new FDA analysis released today shows the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine to be effective with no safety concerns ahead of a committee meeting on Friday to consider authorizing it for emergency use.
Meanwhile, Pfizer and Moderna have pledged a combined 220 million doses of their already approved vaccines to the U.S. by the end of March. But it is a race against time. Research published in the New England Journal of Medicine found those two vaccines may be less effective against the South African strain of the coronavirus. So how does it work to tweak a vaccine for a new variant? Let's bring in Dr. Drew Weissman. He's professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. His research helped develop the mRNA technology used in the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Dr. Weissman, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And first, what steps have Pfizer and Moderna already taken to adjust their vaccines for these variants?
So the approach they're taking right now is to make a booster. And that booster has one of the variants, likely the South African, that can be used to immunize people who have already received the original vaccine.
So on a very basic level then, what does it take to make those changes?
For mRNA, it's simple. I was talking with Ugur Sahin, the CEO of BioNTech. It will take them 6 weeks from the time they get a new variant to make a vaccine that's ready to give to people. You simply pop in the new sequence into the mRNA and you're done.
Now, the FDA said this week that these tweaked vaccines would not need to go through the same kind of vigorous trials that the original did. Can you explain, well, first of all, if you agree with that decision, and why it's not necessary?
So we've been doing this with flu for many years. Every year we have new flu vaccines that are chosen from what people think will infect the population. Those do not go through any clinical trials. They're tested in animals to be sure that they make an immune response, and then they're given to people. The variants aren't that different. They differ by, average around 20 amino acids out of 400. So they're minor changes.
And yet, it seems like there are quite a few variants emerging. How do you think these companies are going to be able to keep up with all of them? Is there a way that they would make a booster for each variant?
Yeah, so that would be very difficult because it would mean immunizing people 10 or 20 times. My lab, in collaboration with others, are working on alternative methods, and those include making vaccines that cover all of the variants and all of the variants that could possibly appear.
I see. And what kind of testing would these boosters go through so that we know they're safe?
So the ones that Moderna and Pfizer are doing, I'm sure they're going to require animal studies to show that they make a good immune response and the immune responses are protective against both the variant and the original vaccines.
And what sort of information, I think this is the big question here, what sort of information would you need to see that would tell you that it's time to go from testing these boosters to actually putting them into people's arms? How do we know when it's time?
So the biggest concern is that a variant appears that can infect somebody who's already been infected with the original virus. And if that occurs and it starts to spread, then we need to do something to immunize against the variant.
If someone has gotten, let's say, the Moderna vaccine, both doses, and all of a sudden they end up sick in the hospital with one of these, say the South African variant, that would be an indicator that something's going wrong.
Well, not one person, because what we know is that in a population, in 100 people, a few of those people have a weaker immune response. Those people have already shown they can get reinfected with the same, exact same virus. What we'd want to see is that in a population, 10, 20, 30% of people who had the vaccine are now coming down with a new variant.
I see. Do you think we'll get to that point?
I hope not. I mean, the key to it is to immunize the world as fast as possible. Because if the virus can't replicate, if it can't spread, it can't form variants.
Now, from a purely practical and almost logistical point of view, tell me this. If you've already gotten a second dose of Pfizer and Moderna and you've gone through all of the waiting in line it took to do that and navigating the systems, this means, I imagine, that you'd have to wait again for a third shot all over again. How complicated would it be to add that booster into the mix?
I think we've had so much practice figuring out how to distribute the current vaccine that it won't be as much of a nightmare as the original vaccine distribution was.
And just your final takeaway here about, you know, how big of an undertaking this is. You mentioned we do this every year with the flu vaccine. I just wonder what lessons we might be able to draw from that.
Well, we've known since this virus first appeared that variants were going to happen. It's a bat virus that jumped into humans. The virus wants to figure out how to infect humans. So we should have been preparing for this months ago.
Dr. Drew Weissman, professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Reopening schools during the pandemic is a huge issue here in the United States. But let's check in now on how another country is handling that challenge. In Germany, some elementary school students in more than half of the country's states are back in the classroom after more than 2 months at home. This is the first major relaxation of COVID-19 restrictions since shutdowns began around Christmas. German officials also say hairdressers will be able to reopen on March 1st. NPR's Rob Schmitz joins us now from Berlin. Rob, talk about these school reopenings. It must be a huge relief for parents, especially those who work.
Yeah, it is. And for those who've had to juggle their work with overseeing online learning for their young children. And to clarify, only grades 1 through 3 are back in classrooms this week. And most states of Germany are splitting the classes so that half the class comes one day and the other half on the other day. The reason this is not happening in every German state is because Germany has a federal government where the states are in charge of both their own education and healthcare system. So each of the country's 16 states are making their own calls. And as of now, 6 German states are waiting to put kids back in the classrooms.
Well, Germany has had more than 2 million coronavirus infections and 68,000 deaths. How would you characterize the pandemic there right now?
Well, after an initial success managing the virus, Germany's numbers began to rise in the autumn, and the government didn't really act fast enough. And that led to a rather large second wave of the virus that forced the government to issue a light lockdown in November and then what it called a hard lockdown in December when all non-essential shops and all schools were ordered shut. We're gradually coming out of the lockdown now with school, you know, gradually opening depending on the grade and shops set to open in a few weeks. But health authorities are now worried that they've opened everything up too soon. The coronavirus variants are now here, and that's led to a spike in cases in the past week.
And what about vaccines, Rob? I understand that there's some reluctance in Germany to take specifically the AstraZeneca vaccine. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it seems like everything surrounding the AstraZeneca vaccine has become controversial in the EU. Earlier this month, the company said it wasn't going to deliver on its promise of an initial 180 million doses for Europe. And now many people here in Germany are reluctant to take the vaccine because its efficacy rate is lower than other vaccines. And perhaps more importantly, because the German government advised people over the age of 65 not to take the vaccine because of a lack of data on its efficacy for people in that age group.
And so I'm reading here that fewer than 200 people are showing up for, you know, 3,800 daily appointments at centers in Berlin.
Yeah.
That's a lot of doses that are going unused.
Yeah, and it's a big setback. And government officials are telling the public that they're going to prolong the pandemic if they continue to refuse vaccines. And what's surprising here is that this attitude is not limited to the AstraZeneca vaccine. A survey released today by the Bertelsmann Foundation shows that more than a third of Germans surveyed say they don't want to take any vaccine. You know, there's been a lot of skepticism here about all stages of the government's response to the pandemic. And this looks like it's extending to vaccines as well.
One more question, Rob. German border police have been turning back thousands of people who wanted to cross into Germany from neighboring countries. The EU wants Germany to lift those sanctions. Tell us about this.
Yeah, one of the European Union's founding principles was to ensure for the free movement of people and goods throughout the continent. And the EU says Germany's border closures with Austria and the Czech Republic violate these principles, and they've given not only Germany, but also Belgium, Denmark, Finland, Hungary, and Sweden 10 days to respond to their concerns about this. For Germany, this is a big concern because the first wave of the virus was believed to have come from skiers returning to Germany from Austria, where they had been infected. It's not known when these border restrictions will be lifted, but with the new variants now in Germany, it's likely that German leaders will be taking a more cautious approach going forward.
And what's the attitude, generally speaking, across the EU? Are people frustrated? Are they must be ready for this to be over, as we all are?
Yeah, I think everyone's really fatigued and frustrated right now, wherever you go. What's different about Europe is that they're seeing their compatriots in America and the UK getting the vaccine to a point where non-elderly people are starting to get vaccines in those areas, and they're getting a little impatient.
NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Rob, thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
It looks like President Biden's pick to run the Office of Management and Budget is running into serious confirmation trouble. This morning, two Senate committees canceled meetings on the nomination of Neera Tanden. Tanden's future is in question because of past tweets denigrating people in both parties. This afternoon, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked if Tanden has withdrawn her nomination.
The stage we're in is working to continue to fight for her nomination. And as you know, it's a numbers game, right? It's a matter of getting one Republican to support her nomination. We're continuing to do that outreach, answer questions they have, and continue to reiterate her qualifications.
Our political strategists join us now. We've got Matt Mikowiak, our Republican. Matt, welcome.
Howdy.
And Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Jamal, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you're welcome. And Jamal, let's start with you. The White House says there that it's still fighting, but was that Tanden nomination a misstep in the first place?
I wouldn't say it's a misstep. I think the president had a reasonable expectation that the rules applied to Republican nominees would be the same rules applied to Democratic nominees. But it turns out that Democrats are going to be held to a higher standard than Republicans were. And, you know, sometimes those are the breaks. The reality here is, though, that we've got to come up with some rules of the road going forward, and having Republican partners in the Senate who are willing to say, you know, what's out of bounds. What we can't have is hypocrisy ruling the day in the United States Senate.
I just want to make sure I understand exactly what you're talking about here. Are you referring to the fact that Neera Tanden's Twitter feed essentially is coming under question when Republicans never said anything about, you know, Donald Trump for the past 4 years, and then didn't seem to have much of a problem with his Twitter feed?
They didn't say anything about Trump. They didn't say anything about Rich Grenell, the ambassador to Germany, who attacked Michelle Obama, attacked Barack Obama's kids. You know, so the idea that one has to have a pristine Twitter feed in order to get a United States Senate confirmation was not held. We were not held to that standard during the Trump administration.
I see. Matt, what do you think about that? Is it fair?
Well, Rick Grenell was confirmed to be U.S. ambassador to Germany, and then he was named acting director of national intelligence. So, you know, at the end of the day, as Jen Psaki said in the soundbite, it is a numbers game. I think the problem here is that the math only works for the Democrats if all the Democrats stick together. You have a 50-50 Senate. You have to have 51 votes to get confirmed. 50 Democrats plus the vice president gets you there. But when Joe Manchin decided to oppose her nomination, it now creates a situation where they need at least one Republican. And based on what we know, there's only one person left who is up for grabs, and that's Lisa Murkowski, the moderate Republican from Alaska. I imagine that they delayed the hearing today because she didn't have the votes, and that's probably a signal that the moderate Democratic senator from Arizona, Kristen Sinema, was not prepared to vote in favor of Tanden's nomination. Look, but White House Budget Director, Jamal knows this, is one of the five most powerful jobs in the federal government. This is not a reflection of Neera Tanden as a person or whether her Twitter feed is pristine or not. It's a question of whether her temperament is such that she should be put in such a position of immense federal responsibility. And I think at the end of the day, you're now going to have 51, maybe 52 senators who are going to conclude that she does not need to be confirmed by the Senate for this particular position.
We'll see, and perhaps soon. Jamal, and I just wonder if there's anything actually special about this case. Doesn't this happen all the time? A new administration comes in and the opposing party looks for, you know, maybe at least one nominee to try to flex its might and scuttle.
Sure, they do. But these aren't normal times. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We have had a presidency that ended with an armed insurrection at the Capitol. You know, the last president was held to absolutely zero standards. Now, I think at least the Biden administration is putting forward people who have real qualifications. They have real background in what they're doing. They have real standing in the national policy community. So I think we should give the Biden presidency its due and allow him to get his nominees through. This is not the time to be playing politics. And Republicans really just don't have a leg to stand on when it comes to trying to hold people to some sort of moral standard.
All right. Well, another major story
one thing
that's
to
happening
that, if I,
on the, oh, sure. Yeah, quickly, yeah. Matt, please.
I'm sorry. Just one thing. I mean, Donald Trump was elected president. Neera Tanden hasn't been elected to anything. Right. So, you know, she has to be confirmed by the United States Senate. They have advising consent responsibilities. Jamal needs to be mad at Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin's on board. She would get confirmed 51-50 and she'd be White House budget director in a week or so.
OK, we could go back and
I
forth
am
on
mad
that
at
quite
Joe
a
Manchin.
Bit. But let's, yeah. OK, fair enough. You got that in.
I am mad at Joe Manchin.
Fair enough. Let's move to the other big news on the Hill, that Senate hearing yesterday. Where we heard that on January 5th, the FBI sent a memo about extremists prepared to wage war in Washington the next day, January 6th, at the Capitol. Of course, we found out that was true, but according to the testimony from law enforcement yesterday, nobody saw it. Jamal, stick with you. What did you take away from yesterday's hearings?
Well, listen, the facts are what they what we know, what we saw with our own eyes, which is that there wasn't armed insurrection at the Capitol. We know that the President of the United States encouraged the people to come and encouraged them to go to the Capitol and ramped up the language for folks who were going there. We know that the military, National Guard, was not sent in for hours to come back and help rescue the Capitol. And we also know that there were Capitol Police who were heroes. Now, what's at question is, whose job was it to pass along the intelligence and get it to all the proper authorities to make sure they understood how big of a threat this was going to be. And I think that's what this investigation is about.
Matt, one thing I want to ask you about, this was, and one thing I found to be very interesting about this is that it seemed, for the most part, and I do say for the most part, bipartisan. We did hear, though, from Republican Senator Ron Johnson describe the crowd as mostly jovial and friendly, and he then spread a false conspiracy theory about who caused the violence and trouble that day. Let's listen.
Plainclothes militants, agents provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and then disciplined, uniformed column of attackers. I think these are the people that probably planned this.
Again, we know that's not true. It's false. But also yesterday, this is compelling too, Wyoming Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney said that Republicans must make it clear that they are not the party of white supremacy.
What happened on that day must never happen again. And we must not look away or trivialize it.
So, Matt, the fight between these two factions of the Republican Party is still going strong. From your perspective, what did you hear from those two people, and which side has the advantage at this moment?
That's an interesting second question. I think among the Republican base, unfortunately, they're probably a little bit more aligned with what Ron Johnson had to say. But I think if we're going to get back to being a governing party again, we're going to have to move in the direction of what Liz Cheney had to say. We absolutely have to reject white supremacy. I mean, I don't want to know anybody that doesn't reject white supremacy. And I go even further than that. I reject white nationalism. I've said that on my Twitter feed, going after people in Texas who have, you know, said that they're in favor of that kind of stuff. But I associate exactly with what Jamal said. Look, we need a serious investigation around everything that happened January 6th. It's now clear there was a law enforcement and intelligence failure. That's shocking to me. You know, Jamal's worked in the White House. I've worked in the White House. The fact that you have the Vice President of the United States, you have constitutional officers in the line of succession all at one place at one time. You have the D.C. police, you have the Capitol police. The fact that they're not sharing intelligence from the FBI and treating that event as a national security event and giving it the priority it needed is shocking in a 20 years after 9/11. I thought we fixed that with the 9/11 commission. We clearly didn't. So there's a breakdown there that has to be addressed. It's totally unacceptable. And it's an absolute miracle. The vice president, the speaker of the House, other members of the House and Senate were not killed that day when more than 100 people breached the Capitol for the first time since the 1800s that had weapons on them, you know, mere seconds away from confronting the vice president of the United States. It's absolutely, totally unacceptable, and we have to get to the bottom of it.
I was going to ask you both to look ahead to the weekend when, of course, we know that the former president will be speaking, or is at least scheduled to be speaking, at the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC. I was going to ask you to weigh in on that, but instead I'm going to, because we're going to all be watching that very, very closely when that comes. But instead, I want to ask you to do something else. Reflect, if you could, on the pace of your own life now that you're not responding to everything that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth or from his Twitter feed, Jamal.
Well, it certainly just seems to be more sane. I was struck watching Joe Biden's town hall on CNN last week. At one point, I just sort of exhaled and thought, this is just so normal. whether you agree with the policy or not, it's just a president who seemed informed. He seemed like he was, even if he was shading the facts to make himself look better, it was inside the bounds of reality, and not something that was, ad hominem attacks and going after people for no reason at all.
Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, look, the chaos that surrounds Donald Trump, that is partially driven by him and partially a response to what he says and what he does, I think is fundamentally, a big problem to being efficient and being productive and being strategic. And I think the biggest mistake he made was making Steve Bannon his senior strategist in the White House on day one. That guaranteed that level of chaos going forward. So, you're right. It's more normal now. We can sleep through the night, not have to worry about a 5 a.m. tweet against North Korea setting something off. We're going to be in more normal times, but obviously the country's still divided and the parties are still fighting. And I haven't seen the unification that I think we all hoped that Joe Biden could engender. And I think it would be a good thing for the country if he could find a way to do it.
Matt Mikowiak is our Republican strategist today. Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Thanks to you both very much.
Take care.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
In recent mass shootings, people have been targeted for who they are or who they worship. But on June 28, 2018, people were targeted for the job they do at a newspaper. Listen to the new series from NPR's Embedded about the survivors at the Capitol Gazette.
New research published in a journal of the CDC tells us something about kids, their immune systems, and returning to school in the pandemic. Researchers studying kids in Hong Kong found that after children returned to school, many got sick, not from COVID, but from rhinoviruses that cause the common cold. This, despite wearing masks. Helen Branswell is with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Helen, welcome. Great to speak with you.
Hi, Jane.
So COVID has been dominating the headlines, but we're also reading these reports about the rhinovirus. Remind us what it is, the symptoms, and the factors that increase the risk of infection.
Okay, so rhinoviruses are a large family of viruses, more than 200. They cause about a third of all things that people describe as when they say they have a cold, there's a good chance it's a rhinovirus. They're generally mild. In fact, always mild, I think, effectively. You get a stuffy nose, you may develop a cough, you don't feel well for a few days, and then you get better.
So what's interesting is that despite mandatory mask wearing, children are still getting sick. How many cases have been reported so far, and who's most at risk for the rhinovirus?
I don't have overall numbers of cases, but that's not the way they counted. What they did was they looked at, they started to see in Hong Kong a whole bunch of outbreaks in schools. They'd been out for quite a protracted period in 2020, and when they went back into in-person learning last October, within a couple of weeks, all of a sudden, kids were starting to get sick, and because of COVID, child that develops respiratory symptoms has to be tested. And all of these kids, I think at least initially, had to be tested. And then what they saw was this was not COVID, it was not influenza, it was rhinoviruses. What was interesting about that is, as you noted, there were all sorts of precautions put in place. The kids had to wear masks, the desks were spaced out, And in addition to that, they were only doing half days. So there was no lunch hour, no time when the kids would have to take off their masks to eat. Yeah, exactly. And even with all of that, they were catching rhinovirus infections. And so eventually what authorities in Hong Kong did was they closed the schools again because, you know, this was taking up too much of their lab testing capacity, having to look into these outbreaks, which I think numbered almost, you know, 500 in schools there.
So with more and more kids back in school for a spring session, what does this mean for us in the United States?
What the experts are saying is, you know, whether it happens in the spring or in the autumn, when you have a bunch of kids who haven't had exposures for a while getting back together again, you're probably going to see something similar. And, you know, one of the things that was clear from the Hong Kong circumstance was that the precautions that were good enough to keep kids from catching COVID and influenza were not sufficient to protect them from rhinoviruses. Hmm. Rhinoviruses are much hardier on surfaces. They're harder to clean off surfaces. So, you know, the issue of fomites, picking up germs from surfaces, is probably a bigger transmission issue with rhinoviruses than it is with COVID.
So interesting. Helen Branswell is with our partners at STAT. Helen, thanks for the information. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The state of Connecticut will soon start vaccinating people for the coronavirus strictly by age. That means the state is shifting priority away from grocery workers and the medically vulnerable. That's who the CDC currently recommends should be next in line for the shots. Joining us now is the Democratic Governor of Connecticut, Ned Lamont. Governor, welcome to Here Now. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here, Jane.
So starting March 1st, people ages 55 to 64 will be able to get COVID vaccines in Connecticut, and you hope to be vaccinating people aged 16 to 34 by the beginning of May. And teachers and daycare providers also can receive vaccines. As you know, Governor, there's been a lot of pushback to your decision. Explain your reasoning here.
We started out with the people 75 and above because that's where over half of the fatalities were. Then we almost all of them, or 70 plus percent of them, have been vaccinated. Then we moved to 65 and above, again, because that's where the comorbidities were likely, the complications. And then we moved to 55 and above starting on Monday, as you point out. 96% of everybody that suffers complications from COVID are 55 and above. Most of them have a pre-existing condition or a comorbidity. And rather than picking and choosing who's a more essential worker or what comorbidity is more severe than others, we thought this was the way we could do it fairly and get it done with the group that's most at risk.
But you hear the concern, right, Governor? People say it's not fair to give a vaccine to a healthy 55-year-old with good health insurance before a 20-year-old who needs a lung transplant or an older grocery store worker on the front lines of the pandemic. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is you can push that 60-year-old back in line, but often that grocery store worker is living in a multi-generational house and that 60-year-old is a father or a grandmother or something. And early on, the reason we were so thankful in testing at the grocery stores and the restaurants and the such is because many of these people lived in multi-generational housing. So now at least they know they can go to work, come back home, and their parent or grandparent is safe to be there.
So will there be any exceptions to these new guidelines?
Very limited. Let's remember, I mean, the CDC list of afflictions, you know, that included probably a half of our total population. So I could have put them all in and called them priority, and they still would have taken probably a couple months to get them all vaccinated.
Governor, a recent examination of population statistics found that your plan to vaccinate people by age means that a higher percentage of white residents will get shots and fewer black residents will. How concerned are you about these disparities in minority communities that have really been hardest hit by the coronavirus?
I'm very concerned. So we have a separate track for underserved communities, black and brown communities, working with the churches, working with the federally qualified health centers, getting mobile testing out there, no questions asked, no cost, obviously, and get as many people. I'm over allocating vaccines to these communities just to make sure they're as likely to get vaccinated as a white couple in the suburbs.
So you're over allocating vaccines, but that leads to a really important question. How can you move forward if vaccines are not available? I mean, a lot of people are having a lot of problems getting their shots.
Yeah, well, you just nailed it. I mean, the real problem is we don't have enough vaccines. I could get everybody vaccinated in a month if we had those vaccines. We don't. Not a state in the country does. Not a country in the world does. So right now we have to prioritize, and I decided to prioritize really with an emphasis upon public health and the groups that most likely to have those comorbidities. That's 55 and above.
55 and above, but how do you plan to address those disparities that I referred to earlier, especially in the black and brown communities?
Yeah, again, we have a separate track. We're bringing those mobile vans right to those communities. We're working with the churches, we're working with the federally qualified health centers. I got ministers reaching out to, you know, underserved families that maybe don't feel a little reluctant. Maybe there's some hesitancy there. Having a trusted advocate say, we're bringing the vaccine to you, and we strongly recommend you get vaccinated. It's good for you, and it's good for your family and community.
So many people waiting for it. Ned Lamont is the Democratic governor of Connecticut. Governor, thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Golf superstar Tiger Woods is recovering today in a Los Angeles hospital after a car crash yesterday morning shattered bones in his leg and required extensive emergency surgery. A statement on his Twitter account said Woods was awake and responsive. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman joins us now. And Tom, this really was a terrible crash. If you've seen the pictures, the front end of his SUV was just about destroyed. What are we learning today about what happened?
Well, hi, Peter. We don't really have much more than what was said in a statement late last night after an entire day of speculation and concern throughout the sports world that basically Tiger Woods had significant injuries to his lower right leg and ankle, fractures in the tibia and fibula bones. Those are the long bones below the knee, and pretty nasty fractures where the bone gets shattered into multiple pieces. And these injuries were stabilized by inserting a rod into the tibia. Now, Woods also had screws and pins put into his foot and ankle to stabilize injuries in those areas. So some pretty severe damage. But, you know, we got to say that we're happy, in a sense, if you can use that word, that we're talking about some pretty bad bone breaks instead of something that really could have been much worse.
No doubt about it. In fact, doctors have said that he is lucky to be alive after that crash. So Woods was already trying to come back from his fifth back surgery in December. Yeah. And on CBS last Sunday, Jim Nantz asked him whether he'd be able to play in the Masters in April. Here's what Woods said.
Gotta hope so. I got to get there first.
You feel like
a lot of it's based on my surgeons and my doctors and my therapists and making sure that I do it correctly. And cause this is the only back I got, so I don't have much more wiggle room left there.
And again, that was before the crash. And now, of course, Tiger Woods facing yet another public trauma, another public recovery in his life. And it does almost seem too soon to talk about another Tiger Woods comeback, but of course, people are going to be wondering about that, aren't they?
Well, of course they are. You know, we've got to let him start to heal, which he is doing now in the hospital. That's the good news. And I mean, you know, we've seen him come back from so much, not just medical situations, but scandal, of course, that began in 2009. But, you know, he, as you said, a fifth back surgery. Remember, he had a spinal fusion a few years back and wasn't sure how that was going to pan out, but of course he you know, it worked for a time, and it allowed him to win his 15th major tournament, the Masters in 2019. Do remember, Peter, that in 2008 he won the U.S. Open with a stress fracture in one of his tibia. So you know, this guy not only can come back from injuries, but he can play with them. We don't know yet if that's too tall an order at this point, with these severe breaks in his right leg.
Yeah, I mean, suffice it to say, no matter what happens, the physical therapy, the recovery will be intense, and we're just going to respect the process there and see what happens because we don't know enough. However, Tiger Woods is an icon in sports and in this country, and he holds a special place for a lot of people despite his controversial decisions through his life.
It's amazing. He's 45 now, past his prime. Let's just admit it. He is past his prime. But every event that Tiger Woods enters, no matter if he, you know, he's not even a favorite anymore, people go, can he get it back? Can he reclaim the Tiger Woods of the early 2000s when he just mesmerized not just the golf world, the entire world? He was a global sports icon. And so as long as he has a pulse, there is always this feeling that, can he do it? Can he do it? And severe injuries yesterday, but already yesterday, you were hearing and reading about these hopeful comparisons to another golfing legend, Ben Hogan. He almost right. died in a car crash in 1949, came back and won golf tournaments, big tournaments as well. So we just don't know.
People are rooting for Tiger Woods. NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Peter.
The winter growing season for produce appears to be ending early in Texas after crops were wiped out by last week's freeze. Our next guest says 80 to 95% of the state's leafy greens have been destroyed, and that could have big implications for farmers, supply chains, and jobs. Dante Galeazzi is president of the Texas International Produce Association. Dante, welcome. Up to 95% of leafy greens lost. That is devastating.
Yeah, that is devastating. I mean, this comes on top of last year's just terrible season, which was impacted by the pandemic in March. These guys got hit by the hurricane in July. They started out this fall with drought-like conditions, so they had water limitations. And then here they are with, you know, 6 to 9 weeks left in their leafy green season, and boom, they're hit by a freeze. You know, the last time we had a freeze like this was 1989. So
wow.
There was no way of knowing or seeing this until 4 days before it happened. So, I mean, just absolutely terrible.
Yeah, and thankfully things are starting to thaw out now. But when you go to these farms and you survey the damage, what are you seeing?
I'll give you the example of lawns, right? Just driving around neighborhoods here, all the lawns were green. And then by Thursday of last week, literally everything is yellow. That's what you're seeing in the fields. You know, driving past a field of cilantro and some broccoli plants the other day, half of them were drooped over. The other half were kind of standing, you know, 2-3 inches tall. But by Friday, Saturday of last week, as the cold temperatures just kind of lingered on, the plants were just laying entirely on the ground. And that is a terrible, terrible sign.
Yeah. So in that case, what are your conversations with farmers been like over the past few days? What are they telling you?
Oh, they have not been great. The conversations have been about what they think they can try to salvage. And, you know, the other big factor they got to work into this, Peter, is if they have to go in and they end up spending, you know, 2 or 3 hours to get very little pack out, is there an actual return on that investment? Is it just better to take that first loss and wrap it up and put the field to plow? Or does it make sense to go out, get 150 people, put them through that field, incur all of that additional labor, processing, packing, and shipping costs if you're still going to have a tiny return or no return?
Well, and is there any chance that some of these farmers could replant their fields, or is it just too late for that?
Unfortunately, it is too late. We're at the point in the season where in April, we're going to start getting 100-degree days every single day. So what happens is immature or very young plants do not do well under those conditions. So we're beyond the replanting.
As we said, you know, this is not just about farmers that are going to feel the impact of this.
Mm-hmm.
Could affect the produce supply chain. I know Texas grows much of the domestic produce market in the United States in the winter. It also could affect people's ability to find work right now at a very difficult time in the economy. So what are you seeing about the way this will play out over the weeks and months ahead?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it's going to impact thousands of jobs. It's first off, it's going to start with the jobs for the folks that work in the fields, right? They're not going to have any work for the next 2 to 3 months. And then you've got the folks that work in the warehouses and the packing facilities. They're not going to have any work for the next few months because as long as there's no produce, there's not people needed for packing. And then you're going to have all the other allied or auxiliary industries that provide supplies that are going to be impacted. Boxes, pallets, straps, labels, washing materials, chemicals, shipping, transportation, receiving, distribution, logistics. All of those variables in that supply chain are going to be impacted when you just don't have the product.
So what does that mean for prices at the grocery store if we've lost so many crops? Are we going to be paying more for a bunch of cilantro?
It's very likely consumers from Texas all the way north through the Midwest are going to experience some additional costs. And those costs are basically going to be the logistics involved in getting product from a different growing region. Those additional miles aren't free. Someone's going to have to pay for them. That someone usually ends up being the American consumer.
Dante, it feels like I've been having conversations with farmers for a very long time now, but it's just like a really tough time to be a farmer, right? And I guess the cynic could say, well, at least they probably have crop insurance, right? But what do you say about what farmers need right now in terms of support to get through yet another crisis?
Well, unfortunately with vegetables, there's really only two of the vegetable crops that we grow down here in Texas that even have a crop insurance plan specific to that commodity. So insurance is not going to save these farmers. Unfortunately, what we're going to be having to ask our friends in DC for is some sort of direct payment or assistance program, because really, Peter, it's going to be all about getting these farmers some sort of financing or funds so that way they can put the next crop in the ground and have a chance.
Dante Galeazzi is president of the Texas International Produce Association. Thank you very much.
You got it. Thank you, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now.